Michael, I'm so glad you told us about that. It was beautiful. Love the words to that. So as Paul mentioned, I'm just getting back from vacation. What he didn't mention was that I texted him after 2 weeks of being gone, and I said, you know, I kind of like being on a ship. They feed you and clean up afterwards. They come and make your bed while you're gone, and they let you see the world. And it's really great. I'm thinking I might not come back to Kansas after all. And I won't quote exactly what his text back came, but it says something about heck no. It's nice to be missed, and it's nice to be needed. And I was so very grateful that we have the lay leaders that we have and the staff that we had who so ably did everything in my absence that I didn't feel guilty and they didn't feel like I had abandoned them. So that was a wonderful gift to me. I do want to say one thing about the Feminine Faces of God. This is a short class. It's probably going to be 2 to 3 weeks on Monday afternoons, and it's going to be the biblical examples of how God is seen from both the Hebrew perspective and also the New Testament perspective as having feminine traits. And there are many biblical texts about this. And so I hope you'll join me tomorrow afternoon, 1 o'clock in the downstairs classroom, and we'll do this class for about 2 to 3 weeks. So in a crowded waiting room in a doctor's office, you've been there, right? A woman received a telephone call on her cell phone. She began a long conversation in a voice everyone could hear, and soon all of us got all the details that none of us wanted to know about the schedule that she had had that day, what she had had for lunch, a few problems in her family, and worst of all, why she was at the doctor's office. Rude! Not much later, speeding by me on K96 was a young man in a bright red car, and as he sped along, he thumbed his cigarette out the window, and sparks flew near his exhaust. Rude! These people can get me in a bad mood. We've all experienced some of those kinds of behaviors that are rude, impolite, or just not very nice. But likewise, we've all had good experiences with people. And I ask the question, is there less civility in American society now than in the past? Are manners and politeness waning? Does our faith speak to behaving in a certain civil manner? Well, here's what the Apostle Paul has to say in our traditional word for today. Companions, as we are in this work with you, we beg you, please don't squander one bit of this marvelous life that God has given us. God reminds us, I heard your call in the nick of time. The day you needed me, I was there to help. Well, now is the right time to listen, the day to be helped. Don't put it off. And don't frustrate God's work by showing up late, throwing a question mark over everything we're doing. Our work as God's servants gets validated, or not, in the details. People are watching us as we stay at our post, alertly, unswervingly, in hard times, tough times, bad times, when we're beaten up, jailed, and mobbed. Working hard, working late, working without eating, with pure heart, clear head, steady hand, in gentleness, in holiness, and honest love, when we're telling the truth, and when God is showing God's power, when we're doing our best, setting things right, when we're praised, and when we're blamed, slandered, and honored, true to our word, though distrusted, ignored by the world, but recognized by God, terrifically alive, though rumored to be dead, beaten within an inch of our lives, but refusing to die, immersed in tears, yet always feeling deep joy, living on handouts, yet enriching many, and having nothing, having it all. Aren't those beautiful words to describe the complexities of our lives? Well, the word civility was popularized in the 16th century by Erasmus, who was a Dutch philosopher and theologian, and he actually wrote On Civility in Children. That's where we want civility to happen. Those of us who are grown up, we like to think that children are the place where civility needs to be taught. And the concept of civility is actually related, of course, to the words civilization and civilized. It has to do with how we live together, and its root means member of the household. Member of the household. So Erasmus observed, to be civilized is to understand that we must live in society as a household, and that within that household, if we are to be moral people, our relationships with other people are governed by standards of behavior that actually limit our freedom. Our duty to follow those standards does not depend on whether or not we happen to agree or even like each other. Wow, that's what Erasmus said. Have you or anyone you've ever known said, well, I'm kind of old enough now that I don't really care about getting others' approval. I'm going to kind of live the way I want to live and to heck with the rest of them. But when we say things like this, and I've heard myself say it, well, I've heard the voice come out of my mouth saying it. But when we say things like this, we're actually ignoring our faith and betraying our belief. There are ways in which we are expected to be members of a household. And it has more than to do with courtesy, but it has to do with respect. It has to do with the lack of self-gratification. Because, you see, individualism has become a high value in our society, right? But that flies in the face of what our faith teaches us. I heard some time back that Frank Sinatra's old song, I Did It My Way, was the number one song requested at funerals. Well, not in the church. I mean, I've done a few with that song, and I like that song as well as anyone else. But it flies in the face of our faith. It tells us that we can make our own rules. We can do what we want. We can have it our way. But the more we focus on self-gratification and ourselves, the less moral energy we have that is available to spend on others, and the less attuned we are to others' well-being. So as a civil person in a household, we want to step away from that self-gratification. And the selfish individualism flies right in the face of community and of relationships, something that Jesus talked about all the time. Pier Massimo Forné teaches Italian literature at Johns Hopkins University, and he and some of his colleagues formed the Johns Hopkins Civility Project. Forné ended up writing a book entitled Choosing Civility, the 25 Rules of Considerate Conduct. I'm guessing that if we read it together as a book, that we could come up with about 50 additional rules of conduct. But what he says is interesting. He says, life is relational. Life is what relationships make it. So good relationships make our life good, and bad relationships make our lives bad. We exist and we perceive our identity only in relationship with others. He says that often we think of good manners as what we teach children to say, please and thank you and so forth, and to chew with their mouths closed, please. That's a big one. But this is a very limited view of what it means to be a civilized person, to live in relationship. The Latin root of manners is hand. Manners are something that are done or handled. We have good manners when we handle others with care. Our hands can strike or they can lift up. They can soothe or they can destroy. They can heal. And that's why civility matters. Think about Jesus' stories. The Good Samaritan who used his hands in a good way. The prodigal child who did not. The forgiving landowner who behaved in a civil way, the unforgiving servant who did not. You see, the Bible is full of stories of people being gracious to one another, which is the height of good manners. And that graciousness extends not only to our friends and those we like, but especially, Jesus taught, to others. People we don't know, people we disagree with, people who are different from us, strangers, foreigners, the rejected, all of those others. So civility begins with awareness. Fournet says being civil means being constantly aware of others and weaving restraint, respect, and consideration into the very fabric of our universe. So to be kind, we need to begin with an interest in the well-being of others and transcend our tendency towards selfishness. Remember, we don't always have to agree with one another to offer respect and kindness and understanding. A recent example of this was at the graduation at Notre Dame several years ago. President Obama was asked to speak at the graduation. Now, Notre Dame, as you know, is a Roman Catholic university, and the Roman Catholic stance on abortion is very well known. And President Obama, as you probably know, is an advocate for choice. So that made some very major controversy when he was announced as the graduation speaker. There were pickets, there were demonstrations, there was a huge uproar, and all kinds of chaos erupted. Some people didn't think that the president of Notre Dame would actually go through with having President Obama there. But I want you to hear the president of Notre Dame's comments when he introduced the president. Now remember, this is a Catholic priest who has everything to lose by standing in front of the university in support of President Obama. He disagreed with him, but he extended grace to someone with whom he had radical disagreement. This is what he said. More than any other problem in the arts or sciences, in engineering or medicine, is easing the hateful division between human beings, and that is the supreme challenge of our age. Of course, dialogue is never instantaneous. It doesn't begin and end in an afternoon. It's an ongoing process made possible by the many acts of courtesy and gestures of respect. It's made possible by listening carefully and then speaking honestly. Paradoxically, support for these actions often falls as the need for them rises. So they are most controversial precisely when they can be the most helpful. As you know, he said, a great deal of attention has surrounded President Obama's visit to Notre Dame. We honor all people of goodwill who have come to this discussion respectfully and out of deeply held conviction. Most of the debate has centered on Notre Dame's decision to invite and to honor the president. But less attention has been focused on the president's decision to accept our invitation. President Obama has come to Notre Dame, though he knows full well that we are fully supportive of church teaching on the sanctity of life, and we oppose his policies on abortion and embryonic stem cell research. Others might have avoided this venue for that reason. But President Obama is not someone who stops talking to those who differ from him. Mr. President, and he turned, this is a principle we share. As the fathers of the Second Vatican Council wrote in their pastoral constitution, respect and love ought to be extended to those who think or act differently than we do in social, political, and even religious matters. In fact, the more deeply we come to understand their ways of thinking through such courtesy and love, the more easily we will be able to enter into dialogue with them. And then he said, if we want to extend courtesy, respect, and love, and enter into dialogue, then surely we can begin by acknowledging what is honorable in others. Isn't that beautiful? The way he turned it to represent the acceptance of the invitation of President Obama. Well, there's a story with many variations about the Buddha, and a delegation of seekers came to the Buddha to learn from his wisdom. Deeply impressed with him, they ask him, are you a god? No, he said. Are you a saint? No. Are you a prophet? No. Well, who are you? And the Buddha replied, I am awake. To be awake is to be divine. It's to be aware of the needs of others. The stories of rude behavior with which I began this sermon show that those involved and all those other scenarios you thought about, the people were too caught up in their own needs and desires to be aware of the other people around them, putting their own urges before the respect of others. I think good manners, polite and respectful behavior are also rooted in the acknowledgement of the imago Dei, the image of God that is imprinted on every human face. That acknowledgement is at the heart of not only Christian teaching, but most religions. And it's a substantial part of our faith, acknowledging others, being awake, as the Buddha said, means affirming the imprint of God in every human life. I'm increasingly convinced that civility is actually the root problem for much of the world's ills today. If we can't wake up to the people around us, what hope is there for a better world? The end of injustice and peace. Because in order to address issues like homelessness and prejudice and healthcare reform and violence against children and other issues, we first have to learn how to awake ourselves to the world. So we have the potential to bring some saving grace to this world. Sensitivity, mercy, generosity of spirit, a courtesy so deep, it amounts to beauty. We all have to kind of summon up those qualities and decide to use them in our everyday interactions. Scott Peck, in his book Abounding Grace, tells us that we need more thoughtfulness behind the considerations that we pay to others, not merely the golden rule that my brother used to say was do unto others as they did unto you. He usually said that right after I hit him, and it was an excuse to hit me back. And my mother would correct him and say, no, it's do unto others as you would have them do to you. He said, she just hit me. I'm hitting her back. No, it's more than that. The advanced course teaches us, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But only if you were in their unique and very different shoes. This advanced course in consideration and respect has more to do with empathy than sympathy. But don't toss it off as an easy, basically emotional virtue, because it requires a great deal of actual experience of others and the capacity to absorb that experience, but also to think deeply about it. I believe that we try to do that here at UCC, and that we try to model getting along with each other, that is an example of how we would prefer the world to be. And despite our different beliefs, our different politics, our different life choices, our different educations, our different abilities, we're trying very hard to be together the best that we can be. So in your bulletin, there is an insert, which is our contemporary word. It's the principles of engagement for creating civility among people. It's from the National Civility Center. And I'm not going to read it to you because I'm encouraging you to take it home with you, to use it to do roast the preacher at lunch, to seriously, I mean, put it on your mirror in your bathroom or in your billfold and think about it this week. Think about what you can do to bring more civility to our city, to your home, to our nation. I'd invite you to consider these principles, the quote in your bulletin, as we take just a moment of silence before our final song. And now, as you're able, please stand and let's sing our choral benediction together.